Much has been said about the September 11th attacks on the United States. Our guest today has written a book about that event, or more exactly, what key events preceded it. In our opinion, the work should be read by anyone interested in that remarkable day. That is to say, it's a book which should be read by everyone. Embarrassing facts surrounding the 9/11 attacks were downplayed, overlooked, or sometimes ignored completely by official reports, and unfortunately, by the vast majority of the reporting on the topic as well. In The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, Peter Dale Scott, longtime investigator of what he aptly calls deep politics, has continued to do what he's done so well for decades, examine the big picture of what produced an event. The threads which wove themselves in the tapestry of September 11th are certainly worth teasing apart, and we're pleased to attempt just that with Dr. Peter Dale Scott. Dr. Scott, welcome to Radio Parallax.
I'm glad to be with you.
Dr. Scott, far more than the typical investigative reporter, you examine what lies below the surface of events, noting in The Road to 9/11 that you sought to examine how, quote, "It's a story that looks beyond the well-defined public entities of open politics to include the more amorphous and fluid realm of private control behind them." Can we start off by discussing how you define the deep state and the security state?
Right, and as opposed to the public state.
Yes.
Normally, when Americans talk about the state, they're thinking of what they were taught about in civics courses in high school, what's ultimately dependent on the Constitution and a system of checks and balances. That's a system that has lasted now for two centuries. It's a good system, but there have been some very significant changes since World War II and the emergence of what I call a deep state that is really not part of that system at all. The way to visualize it, to think of the CIA, which was set up by a statute, but the statute says almost nothing about it, required to perform, according to the National Security Act of 1947, such other duties as the National Security Council may from time to time direct. Well, there are no checks and balances here. And not only does it not report in this regular way, but it was set up precisely not to be accountable, not to report. And that's the characteristic of what I call the deep state. Now, that doesn't mean that it's totally autonomous doing what it likes somewhere else. The way it was set up in 1947, really, most of the planning for it came from Wall Street and from men like Alan Dulles, who was a Truman, the president, was a Democrat. Alan Dulles was a Republican and a private lawyer in Sullivan and Cromwell, but he had a lot more to do with the formation of the CIA than did Harry Truman. And I regard that as really emblematic of the situation of the deep state that is responsive to what I call an overworld of private interests, Wall Street, lawyers, bankers. Their influence was very, very clear in the CIA when it was set up. Not quite so clear now, but then Wall Street is not quite as powerful now as it was then. Power has gone to other parts of the country as well, Texas, California. So that's the deep state. Now, in between, you asked about the security state. I say very little about the security state in my book, but if you were to go to Europe or some other countries, the security state would be more powerful because there you have, and we do have in America, armies, a military that has, in a sense, its own constituency, particularly in southern states like Georgia and Alabama, where it represents a significant part of the local economy. So the very clear distinction between the public state that is grounded ultimately in the decisions of the people and the deep state that is responsible upwards to the overworld, in between is the security state. Maybe later on we'll say more about it, because Bush and Cheney, since 2001, have done a lot to, in ways that have not been noticed, to increase the power of the military in the domestic United States. I mean, it's very important, for example, they've created a NORTHCOM, which is a command area for the continental United States. This is absolutely new. Before that, our commands like CENTCOM was for the Middle East and SOUTHCOM was for Latin America. And now North America has been added to this global reach of the military. So that's important too, though, as I say less about that in my book.
Let's take a deep plunge here into this area of politics. There's been speculation that the Bush administration allowed the 9/11 attacks to go forward in order to galvanize the nation in what's now a famous phrase, like a new Pearl Harbor, according to the Project for the New American Century. In your book, you're careful not to speculate on a lot of matters, but I think it's worth taking a look at some events that have shown how shadowy moves by intelligence figures have included some surprisingly bloody strategies. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what you mentioned in the book, the strategy of tension that took place in Italy with bombings falsely being linked to left-wing groups, as well as the U.S.'s Operation Northwoods in the 1960s.
Well, yes, the strategy of tension is a term which emerged in Europe in the it was counterinsurgency, counterterrorism theory in Europe with people with whom the CIA was in touch, and specifically the bombings you're talking about. There were two huge ones. One was in Milan, 1969, the Piazza Fontana bombing. And the second one was the Bologna railway station, 1980. I think more than 80 people were killed in the second one. Both were blamed on leftist groups. And we have to understand that leftist groups were, in fact, involved. That's the importance of the analogy with 9/11, because I certainly believe that Al-Qaeda was involved. But the Italian case, these leftist groups had been penetrated by agents of the Italian security agency, and they used arms and resources that way, way back had been set up by the Americans in a program called Gladio, which was creating, when America, rightly, I think, feared that the Soviet Union might sweep over Western Europe, they created what they called stay-behind units in virtually every country on the continent, including Turkey. These units had been created way back in the early 50s, but as time went on, they evolved into something different from the original plan. They became a kind of parallel government which was planning to commit crimes against the regular government in order to create in the public a fear of ordinary open democracy and a desire to move to a more dictatorial state of affairs. The extent to which Americans were involved in this planning is very debated. A lot of Italian generals were ultimately convicted for their role in these bombings, and time after time they would blame the CIA. Well, of course, they had a motive to blame the CIA. But the message I learn from that is how dangerous it is to set up little deep state units that are not accountable to anybody, because they can go off and have a life of their own. Then you asked about Northwoods. I should mention first that one of the people involved in this strategy of tension planning in Italy came to America in 1961 and gave a series of lectures in Annapolis about coup planning in Europe. And then shortly after that, we got from the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1962 a plan called Northwoods, which was remarkably similar to what they were planning at the same time in Italy, which was they were trying to think how they could create public support in America for an attack on Cuba. And they came up with the brilliant idea, well, we could blow up some Americans and blame it on Cuba. Northwoods was quite a lengthy, articulated plan, and it's on the web if anyone wants to look at it.
People should do that, because it seems like something out of like fiction, but yet there was actually a plan to hijack an airliner.
Yes.
And kill people and blame it on the Cubans falsely.
And you can see the documents on the web, and I give the URL, the place to find it, in my book in a footnote when I'm talking about Northwoods. People should read this to realize that, sneaky plots from within this deep state against the government are not unique to the rest of the world. They have happened, at least the planning for them has happened in America. Now, that was back in the 1960s. But as I'm trying to show in my book, there has been continuous planning, in a sense, from units parallel to the government, planning done by people who were not part of the regular government for quite radical changes in this country.
And that certainly will surface again here as we get closer to talking about 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. And
continuity of government, yes.
But the road to 9/11 is actually filled with quite a few remarkable facts that were, I found, very eyebrow-raising. One in particular: the Reagan administration instituted its own Office of Public Diplomacy, staffed by perception management, in quotes, experts from the CIA and special forces. Their goal was to plant anti-communist propaganda in the American press.
Yes. This, now, by the way, you know, when I talked about the being very few controls on the CIA, one of the controls there was that they were never to conduct any operations in this country. What happened under Reagan was that people were seconded out of the CIA, put into this unit which was technically in the State Department, and yes, they were generating propaganda directed at the American people. And if I could say a bit more about it, it's not in my book, but it's relevant, that particularly they were doing this targeting districts where people opposed to the, where Democrats had been elected who were opposed to the Contra program. So they were trying to save the Contra program by defeating Democrats with government money. And I know a lot about this because when all this was being exposed, I was working in Washington with a group advising Senator Kerry in his investigation of Contras and drugs. And I actually interviewed two people from one of these agencies who had a contract. And there was a lawyer in the room. And every time they said, "We're going to target so-and-so," and the lawyer would say, "Please don't say target." we had the transcripts of these meetings.
Wow. People speculate whether this goes on, and it absolutely does.
Yes.
You had a chapter about the decline of the public state, where you show the differences between the public state and security state is really well illustrated by Henry Kissinger. He was directing Pentagon policy back in the 1970s, influenced by private concerns, and he was basically overriding the Secretary of Defense, the ostensible chief of the department. Kissinger was actually personally in charge of where the U.S. was directing bombing raids.
Yes, in the case of Cambodia, very much so. I think the really telling story there is when Nixon and Kissinger went to Iran, and they had State Department advisors and Pentagon advisors, and against the advice of from both sides, they made a deal selling $2 billion worth of arms to the Shah of Iran, which they thought was very clever from an American point of view, because the Shah was reaping in, the price of oil had just quadrupled, and the Shah had all these dollars that he didn't know what to do with, so it would be a big boost to the American arms industry. It was, in fact, a very stupid decision because it created so much inflation in Iran when all the Americans had to come to, you know, install the infrastructure for these new weapons. It created intolerable inflation, and within 7 years, the Shah was out of power. So just, I mean, maybe from one point of view, that was a good thing, but it was certainly not what Kissinger and Nixon intended. It was a stupid policy. It was opposed by the Pentagon. It was opposed by the State Department. And they were there, the advisors, but they didn't know until afterwards that the decision had been made. Now, that's the deep state at work.
Let's stay in the 1970s. An anti-Henry Kissinger neocon coalition emerged. You document this in the book. It marked a move to the right, away from the power of Wall Street and the Council on Foreign Relations, towards a more hawkish group, which was titled Team B. It set out to re-examine the intelligence data. It was criticized then for its hawkish posture, but it does remind people, I think, of the cherry-picking of data that took place before the U.S. attack on Iraq. Can you talk a bit about Team B and how they're still with us?
Well, Team B, technically, there's both a metaphorical Team B and a literal Team B. The literal Team B, in the 1970s, as the Vietnam War wound down, there was a lot of pressure from what we call the traders in Wall Street, the people interested in saving the dollar and having commerce with the rest of the world. These people wanted to see the defense budget reduced, and Jimmy Carter actually ran and won an election with the promise to reduce the defense budget. There were other people, some of them also from Wall Street, but most of them essentially what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, who felt that the best way to save the American economy was to increase the defense budget. This was very hotly contested. And what became crucial was the assessment of the CIA about the Soviet threat. And the CIA was saying, you know, it's not all that bad, it's something we can live with, and therefore we can have detente. Well, Cheney and Rumsfeld back in 1975 had a big role in reversing this, because Ford was the president, and most people, you know, they remember the Nixon presidency as very powerful. Some of the most important decisions governing us today were actually made in the very brief Ford presidency in 1975, when Donald Rumsfeld was Ford's chief of staff, and Cheney, 33 years old, I think, was his assistant. And they arranged this so-called Halloween massacre when a total of 9 people changed their jobs. A crucial one here was that William Colby was fired as the head of the CIA, and George H.W. Bush was brought in from outside to be the new head of CIA. And practically the first thing that George H.W. did was to bring in a new team to assess the Soviet threat. This was something which Colby had been asked to do and had refused to do because he trusted the professional advice. So these known hawks were brought in from outside and said, no, the Soviets are much more dangerous than we thought. And that stuck, that overrode the professional advice. One estimate is, I think, that we spent $3 trillion on armaments since then unnecessarily because of what was essentially a fake assessment, which was incorporated into Jimmy Carter's national security planning. So Carter ended up, though he'd been elected to reduce the budget, huge budget increases, which we think of as the Reagan increases, were actually initiated under Jimmy Carter.
I think it's important to stress that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, looking back, that their data does not stand up, and it does appear that Carter and the nation was sold a bill of goods.
The Soviet Union was already entering into acute economic crisis, which no attention was paid for, and we became so skewed that the CIA eventually, its whole Soviet team having been reshaped by these events, didn't know that the Soviet Union was about to collapse, even though many people in Western Europe did know.
Well, we're at the Carter administration. Everyone knows the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and most people know that Osama bin Laden later got involved with the war there. But something in your book that I found startling, I absolutely did not know, was that that Zbigniew Brzezinski and Robert Gates were promoting the secret funding of Islamic militants in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion, hoping to promote such an invasion.
Yes, and Brzezinski actually boasted about this in the 1990s to a French newspaper, saying that he warned, when he got Carter to approve this program, he warned President Carter that it could induce the Soviets to invade Afghanistan. And the French journalist who was interviewing Brzezinski said, well, don't you regret what you did? And Brzezinski said that back in the 90s. He said, what's more important, the collapse of the Soviet Union or a few angry Muslims? Well, our enemy now is precisely the few angry Muslims that he brushed aside as not being important.
Yeah, you raised the question, who would have been a better foe, Mikhail Gorbachev or Osama bin Laden?
Yes. One of the things that I could have stressed a bit more in the book is that once Gorbachev had taken over, and particularly after Reagan, like Maggie Thatcher in Britain, recognized that Gorbachev was someone you could deal with, then the CIA should have laid off a whole range of tactics they had to weaken and to destroy the Soviet leadership. But they didn't. They went in for the kill. I mean, this is a huge topic, but this is, again, the deep state, public state problem. All the way through, there were advisors in the State Department and other parts of government who said that we should be negotiating with the Soviets, not pinning them to the wall in Afghanistan. And the people who, William Casey, who was the head of the CIA at the time until he died in 1987, these people absolutely insisted that it was more important to make the Soviets bleed, to cause them pain, than to negotiate with them. And I mention that here because it's a little bit the situation we have now in the Middle East. The State Department is saying we should be negotiating with the Palestinians, maybe even with Hamas. And we've got these people who say, no, we can't negotiate. And I very much fear that the result of this will be another U.S. tragic involvement, this time in Iran, which would be so many people, including Brzezinski, see clearly would be, in the long run, absolutely disastrous for the American posture in the world.
Well, let's talk a bit about Iran. In the 1980s, the U.S. elects to use Saddam Hussein to counterbalance the Islamic Republic that was established in Iran that followed the downfall of the Shah. Could you just give us a brief overview of how we set about making Saddam our ally to fight Iran?
Well, we actually played both sides, you remember, because in the Iran-Contra thing, once Iraq started winning, then you had Oliver North with his neat idea, as he called it, of sending arms to Iran. The great irony about this is that the senior emissary who was sent by the Reagan administration to deal with Saddam Hussein in the early 1980s was Donald Rumsfeld, even though at that time he was not in the government, although he was very much involved in covert activities of the Reagan administration.
Staying on Iran, you wrote, "To understand the road to 9/11 is necessary to visit Republican negotiations with Muslim fundamentalists before the 1980 election to stop Carter from negotiating the return of American hostages in Tehran." Again, can we talk briefly about that episode, which you noted that, quote, "even in 2005, accounts of this episode remain outside the confines of mainstream U.S. political history."
Right. Well, first of all, you have to remember that what really destroyed the Carter regime was the disaster of the hostages in the U.S. embassy being seized by Revolutionary Guard in Iran. And that happened and was predicted would happen if America admitted the Shah into the United States, because the new people in Iran feared, I think with some good reason, that if the Shah was in the United States, he would plot with the CIA to be restored. And Carter was advised of all this and refused to admit the Shah to the United States until there was very, very intense pressure from David Rockefeller. Rockefeller hired, I don't know if that's the right word, but he used Henry Kissinger to put pressure on Carter. And Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor, was really a creation of David Rockefeller's. He was propelled into national prominence working for David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission. And eventually, all these people, I have a whole chapter on it, plotted to get Carter to reverse himself. The result of this was that the Shah was admitted, and as predicted, the hostages were seized in the embassy. And then for a whole year, there were negotiations, both Carter's negotiations, but also parallel Republican negotiations to get the hostages released. And it's a very complicated story, but David Rockefeller, again, his men were working with the Republicans, and they were working with people who are prominent in Iranian politics ever since, including today, like Karoubi and so on. And the result was that the hostages were not released until the day that Reagan took over as the new president of the United States.
We're sort of going chronological here. We're in the Reagan-Bush years, I guess, at this point. You note in the book there's a consolidation of the off-the-books government during Reagan-Bush. The scope of the war in Afghanistan is an illustration, I think, of some of that. It's been called the largest covert operation in history, if you can call a war of that scope covert. And at this point, al-Qaeda and other groups become linked to a large number of arms we're shipping to Central Asia and our intelligence agencies.
Yeah, if I could begin with this business about offshoring our assets. The early days of U.S. aid to Afghanistan, first of all, it was mediated through Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, which meant we had no control over it. And, of course, it also meant that the United States could, as it did at the time, deny its involvement. It meant that Pakistan's political objectives took priority, and Pakistan was not interested really in helping the indigenous mujahideen, the freedom fighters, as Reagan called them, because they had their agenda, which was to redefine the Afghan-Pakistani border. So Pakistan was very concerned that most of the aid go to the one leader who was essentially their creation, had very little popular base in Afghanistan, a man called Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. And from an American point of view, he was not good news at all. He was passionately anti-American. He was also funding his operations in part by the drug traffic. And it's said that in the 1980s, he became perhaps the most important heroin trafficker in the world. So that whereas in 1979, almost no heroin came to the United States from that region, the so-called Golden Crescent, by 1981, 60% of the heroin in this country was coming from that area. So from that point of view alone, this was a disaster for America. It was all being done by Casey. A lot of what he did, his own advisors, even inside the CIA, which is, say, inside the deep state, they were saying, don't do this, don't do that. But he would do it anyway in little personal meetings with the head of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was supplying the infrastructure for the campaign in Afghanistan. And it also became, in that decade, the largest drug money laundering bank in the world. And he would do these things with Prince Turki in Saudi Arabia and General Zia in Afghanistan. And one of the worst of these programs, and this was one which was really seriously opposed within the CIA, was to give CIA money, training, etc., to a group called the Maktab-e-Khidmat, the Service Bureau, which was creating a foreign legion in Afghanistan, which was recruiting Islamic extremists from Morocco, Algeria, Egypt, a lot of them actually from the United States. And perhaps the most serious recruiting was done right here in the United States because we were the most open country and the place where it was easiest to do. And the CIA thought this was dangerous because these extremists, they didn't like the Soviet Union, but they also didn't like the United States.
You basically describe fostering a recruiting center in Brooklyn.
Right, yes. The Al-Kifah Center was in Brooklyn for a group which in 1988 changed its goal because now the Soviet Union said, okay, we're going to leave Afghanistan. So this group had to say, what are we going to do now? And they decided to call themselves Al-Qaeda and to continue the fight to liberate Islam from all foreign elements. It wasn't initially planning to bomb in the United States. They were very, very keen on getting the Americans out of Saudi Arabia at first. But it's not that they became anti-American. They were fiercely anti-American while we were recruiting them, financing them. And, there was one of the Afghan leaders who said to somebody in the American government, my God, you're financing your own assassins. And Benazir Bhutto, when she was prime minister of Pakistan, she warned President George H.W. Bush that this was a very, very dangerous program, but Deep State went ahead with it.
And again, as you're describing, things are sort of starting off and spinning a bit out of control. At one point, the Afghans are smuggling drugs into the Soviet Union and also supporting insurgencies, and I imagine Chechnya and the like.
Right. And this, again, was something that Casey was warned not to do. But I think that's actually what Casey's interest in the Foreign Legion was. He wanted to use them not just in Afghanistan, but north of Afghanistan in what was then still the Soviet Union. And they did conduct these operations, and they were mostly foreigners that did them. The Afghans were interested in liberating their country, not in creating trouble somewhere else.
Let's go back to Brooklyn and New York and talk about another one of the bombshells that's in your book, the story of Ali Mohammed.
It's hard to tell this story in a few minutes, but here is he's been called a triple agent because he was actually recruited by the CIA, and they say that they dropped him. But he got to this country. He should have been classified as a terrorist, but an FBI consultant has said that he was admitted to this country on a special CIA program of exempting people from the prohibitions. He worked with special forces. While he was with U.S. special forces at Fort Bragg, he went off for a summer and actually fought in Afghanistan. This is something that American soldiers are not supposed to do unless they're working for some other agency. And to do it chronologically, 1989, he is training people in terrorist techniques in and around Brooklyn, New York. And the date is interesting because in February of 1989, the last Soviet troops had left Afghanistan. He's doing this training in July of 1989, and the FBI is aware of the program, and for a while they're photographing him doing it, so they know who the people being trained, and they know Ali Mohammed is doing the training. And then for some mysterious reason, the surveillance is called off. Some people say that the first Al-Qaeda act of terror in America was when the Jewish racist Meir Kahan was murdered. And he was murdered by three people. And they had these people training on tape together. When they arrested one, and when they went to the man's house, they found the other two, and they found this whole assemblage of materials for terrorism, including plans of the World Trade Center. And these people did actually, some of them, blow up the World Trade Center for the first time in 1993. And yet the New York police and the FBI, they said and there was no evidence that he had connected.
He was killed by a lone gunman. I think we've heard that one before.
The phrase lone gunman was dusted off and used for, even though they had found these other two people in his home. Now, the key man here was not in the home. It was the trainer, Ali Mohammed. And what is so serious about this playing with double agents is that Ali Mohammed in 1993 was picked up in Canada, in Vancouver, by the RCMP because he was waiting for a known terrorist, a man who's now in jail. And they picked him up. And Ali Mohammed gave them a piece of paper and said, phone this number and you will release me. They phoned the number. It was the San Francisco office of the FBI. They did release him because he was an FBI informant. And Ali Mohammed, within a year, had gone to Kenya and photographed the U.S. embassy there, personally took the photographs to Osama bin Laden, with whom he was very close. And the two of them decided where to plant the truck with the explosives that blew up the embassy. So if we hadn't had this special relationship to Ali Mohammed, we might not have had the embassy bombing. And to this day, you know, for that, Ali Mohammed was arrested, but he plea bargained. We don't know the terms of the plea bargain. As far as anyone can figure out, to this day, he's not been sentenced. He's probably somewhere in the witness protection program.
We should know, too, this is a guy, apparently, who told people that he instructed al-Qaeda members how to use box cutters to get on aircraft.
That's right, and where to sit up in first class. It's said that he personally knew at least three of the people. So, in other words, America was not at arm's length from al-Qaeda. Just as, going back to Italy, the Italian secret police were not at arm's length from the anarchists who were blamed initially for the Piazza Fontana bombing.
I'd like to come forward to 9/11, but before we do so, let's just take a slight jog into this area you describe in the book about plans for continuity of government. And I think people associate that with what would happen if there was a nuclear attack. Comedian Will Durst had a very funny line when that came out, when it was revealed, saying, "Boy, this is great. There's a nuclear war. You're fighting with dogs in the street for food. Our cities are leveled, but you can still win the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes because the government has a plan to deliver the mail."
Right. Yes. Well, no, I think it's quite legitimate to have planning for what happens if there's a nuclear attack and the government is, as they say, decapitated. This started in the 50s under Eisenhower and was a perfectly legitimate program then. It changed very much under Reagan. And the proof of the change was at the end of the Reagan administration, they passed an executive order to say that this was no longer planning for a nuclear attack, but for any major catastrophe. And the proof of this is that continuity of government, whatever it is, was actually instituted on September the 11th. And the thesis of my book, or one of the central theses of my book, is that the continuous planning for, in effect, suspension of the Constitution, which began under Reagan, was partially implemented on September the 11th by the very people, which is, say, Cheney and Rumsfeld, who had been planning for this back in the 1980s.
When you say partially implemented, this means that some members of government, among other things, were sequestered away for, you're going to be now the government.
Right. It's very hard for me to say what it meant because we've been told almost nothing. There was one important story in the Washington Post, and we know that Cheney, not on the day itself, September 11th, but shortly thereafter, spent most of the next weeks, months, couple of months, in these hollowed-out mountains, which are have been prepared for sustaining government if Washington is attacked and destroyed, and that something like 100 senior bureaucrats were there with him. So they were doing something. What were they doing? I think they were preparing the Patriot Act. They were preparing for the plans for warrantless surveillance and warrantless detention. All these things happened after 9/11, and we know that they were being planned for in the 1980s by Cheney and Rumsfeld, even though Cheney was only a congressman and Rumsfeld wasn't even in the government. He was not in the government, but he was empowered by Reagan to plan for suspension of the Constitution, and most of Congress didn't know. And what we do know is a few things surfaced in because of Iran-Contra, really. And Oliver North was actually asked about this. Congressman Jack Brooks asked the question, is it true that you have been planning to suspend the American Constitution? And then you got bang, 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 the gavel from Senator Inouye, who said, we have to go into this in executive session, which is a way of conceding that there was something there. And the descriptions of what North was planning for in the 1980s fit very neatly with what has happened to us since 9/11, including plans for martial law. And this whole business of creating a NORTHCOM, I think, is this is no longer planning for a nuclear attack. This is planning for a revamping of the amount of public control over what's going on. You know, just see, you know, we're here, we are talking in late October. We've just had all these fires down in Southern California. How many people noticed that a general from NORTHCOM was down there? As I say in my book, I talked about Katrina, that one of the reasons that the government waited so long in Katrina was that people think that they wanted to use martial law they did use martial law. And they actually used some of these, everyone's heard now about Blackwater, but maybe they don't know that Blackwater security personnel were patrolling in New Orleans. This is exactly the sort of thing that North and Cheney and Rumsfeld were planning for back in the 1980s. So I think continuity of government, COG, it's called for short, and I always say that, of course, it's really planning for change of government, because, when you think of things like the Patriot Act, that's not continuity, that is change. And it wasn't something that was drafted after 9/11. It was clearly there waiting to be brought in, as you quoted yourself, from the project of New American Century in the case of a new Pearl Harbor, which is what we got. What they, in a sense, wanted, needed for their program, and what we got on 9/11.
I was a little bit startled, too, to read in your book that apparently the origins of FEMA are a little shadowy as well.
Yes, again, back to the 1950s, there's been planning for emergencies, and every president had a version of it. But this actually started under Carter, and we owe this, I think, to Zbigniew Brzezinski and his friend Samuel Huntington, who made it very clear in a book which he published in the 1970s that he thought there was too much democracy in America. But that's what we've been dealing with. We've been dealing with well-organized, very small cadres of people who, Cheney being perhaps the most brilliant example of this, who are convinced that America is too democratic to be the kind of leading power in the world that they want America to be. And they have been planning on how to limit democracy. And FEMA came in not just to handle emergencies, but with political agendas. And seeing you've asked, I'll say that one of the first things that FEMA did was set in motion the process which took negotiating with Iran over the hostages out of President Carter's hands and put it into the hands of the banks, so that the banks being, all, you know, David Rockefeller, the chief bank involved in Iran was Chase Manhattan. And the chief source of the breakdown in relations between the post-Shah government and America were the demands. It's really quite conspiratorial and difficult to spell out in a radio broadcast. I have a whole chapter in my book about David Rockefeller's people had a plan to deal with Iran and save their assets and freeze them for, you know, they got frozen inside for until the hostages were released. And there was nothing Carter could do about it. And FEMA played a big role in that.
We should stress, as you mentioned, as a disclaimer, this radio interview is not a substitute for reading the book. You still need to read the book.
Yes.
We got to talk about the day of the attack, 9/11. There's been an awful lot of speculation about what the heck was going on, and you talk about a lot of the aspects of that without getting too speculative. In the book, but you do focus in on Vice President Cheney, particularly in the question of was he in charge that day?
Yes. I'm challenging the conclusion of the 9/11 Commission and its report, which said that this all happened because of chaos in Washington, nobody in control. I think that Cheney was clearly in control. And I think, just to make my own position clear, I have no position on what hit the Pentagon or how Building 7 of the World Trade Center went down. All I know is there has been a cover-up of massive proportions, and the 9/11 Commission became part of that cover-up. And just to give one example to prove that is that we really don't know who the hijackers were, because the names that the FBI came up with, and they had a list of names within an hour of the first attack, included people who then came forward in various parts of the world and said, I'm still here, that's me, that's my picture, I did train at that school, but I'm still alive. And so there was obviously cases of identity theft, and the FBI admitted it at the time. The head of the FBI said, we have to do further research to establish who they were. And when the commission was created, they were given questions by the people who had pushed for its creation. And one of their leading questions, obviously, was, who were these people? And the 9/11 report took the original list from the FBI that was delivered an hour after the attacks and assumed that that was the right list, even though the head of the FBI had admitted there were problems with it. So the cover-up covered them, and their treatment of Cheney is, to me, the most glaring part of the cover-up. Cheney gave two different conflicting accounts of when he got down into the bunker under the White House. I believe that the first one that he gave 5 days later was the correct account. The commission went with a quite different, conflicting account he gave 2 months later and treated it as if that was the given truth, and we know it because, how do we know it? Because Cheney told us. But Cheney also told us something else. They didn't look into that.
And of course, there's tremendous confusion over whether there was a shoot down order, and that they talk about that, but that's really, it's hard to sort that out.
Yes, well, to me, a lot of people have worried about whether Flight 93 was shot down. That's not really part of my book. What I want to look at is how did COG, continuity of government, get instituted on that day? And here you get extreme wooliness from the 9/11 commission. And I think that, it, in fact, the first command with planes had been given, presumably by Cheney, but Cheney is certainly reinforcing it, according to Norman Mineta, who was there in the bunker, sometime around 9:27, which is before even the Pentagon has been hit. And the failure of the commission to query Norman Mineta about this story and to deal with it in their report, it's a symptom, but a very vital symptom of the fact that they are not dealing seriously with what happened. They tacitly, without explicitly saying this, they tacitly say it couldn't have happened because they say that Cheney probably came to the bunker around 2 minutes to 10, which is long after, more than half an hour after what Norman Mineta was talking about. But here again, they're relying on a story that emerged very belatedly. The Norman Mineta story was revamped not once but twice, so that there are in all three versions of Vice President Cheney responding to a plane approaching Washington. The most credible version is Mineta's because it's 7 minutes or so before the Pentagon is hit. But then there was another version that made it, that would have been Flight 77. No, not that flight, Flight 93, and put it a few minutes after. But the 9/11 Commission doesn't mention that story. Again, they tacitly reject it. They like the story that everything Mineta talked about did happen, but it happened about quarter after 10. The most obvious problem with this story is there are no more planes at this point. The planes have all been ordered down. There are no more planes approaching Washington. But they reprint, deadpan, a story based on an account from, guess who, Lynn Cheney, Cheney's wife, that has a plane approaching Washington, straight into Washington at 10:15, when there was no such plane, and the lame excuse of the, or explanation of the 9/11 Commission report is that it was a radar projection of a plane that had actually gone down 15 minutes earlier. All I say about all this is, what happened on that day? I don't know. None of us know. But Cheney is a central figure in this. He has never, ever been required to testify under oath. And my limited request is that Congress set up a hearing in which Cheney, for the first time, will tell us under oath when he got to the bunker and what was this order that he gave about a plane that was approaching Washington, because we don't know.
And if I can quote from a question you raise here, too, in the book, noting it's disturbing that there's been no official report on the activities of this shadow government, the continuity of government issue, or even whether it's still activated.
Yes. If I could say one other thing about 9/11, that is, you know, it's intercepting planes used to happen all the time. And there were 67 of them in 10 months preceding June of 2001. The commission itself says that the failure to intercept has to be blamed on the impossible rules for interception that prevailed at that time. And then in the footnote, you discover that the impossible rules, which meant you had to go to national command, either the president or the secretary of defense, that was instituted on June the 1st, 2001. So a reasonable commission would have tried to find out why they were instituted, who instituted it. And Mike Rupert, who did a lot of work in this area, spoke to a lot of people in NORAD and elsewhere, was convinced that it came out of a task force that clearly was appointed by Bush on May 1st of 2001. And lo and behold, who was the head of the task force? Vice President Cheney. Who were the people advising him? FEMA. FEMA, the people who had been advising all the COG planning all through the 1980s. So these were people getting back together. And 1 month later, we get this rule. Which to all the people I've talked to, I have talked to people who are involved with watching airplanes. And as I say, FAA itself said that it was normal. They're the source for saying there had been this many interceptions. So why were there no interceptions on that day? Because of a new rule? Why was there a new rule? That we still need to find out, and that's one of the questions that should be put to President Cheney when he's under oath.
I've heard Michael Rupert speak. He raises a totally valid question. I think most people remember when that golfer Payne Stewart, their aircraft suffered apparently decompression at altitude, and they had scrambled fighters within minutes. We were actually getting contemporaneous reports over the news media. They've looked in the airplane. There appears to be no activity. So as it was happening, what used to be standard procedure, you would get a report from a jet scrambled to intercept.
Well, Doug, the first time I talked about this, I said what you just said, that they scrambled within minutes. I've been persuaded that it wasn't within minutes, that people misunderstood that when the plane crossed a time zone barrier. So it was within minutes, but it was now in Central Standard Time and not... So, no, it was an hour. But an hour was plenty of time to get planes up to deal with Flight 77 and Flight 93, particularly Flight 93, and it didn't happen. So that the Payne Stewart story, which is in my book, is, in fact, an important story.
Well, it's always good to have a correct diagnosis before you attempt to fix things, and I think your book certainly outlines the true state of affairs in America and the world. In your conclusions, you do find some room for optimism out of all this.
Possible optimism.
Possible optimism.
All right, now let me be optimistic. I think having the internet is a fantastic new... It's a new asset for the government and control, and it's also a new asset for the people to know what's really going on. You know, in the Vietnam War, the only way you could find out what was happening in Vietnam was to go to a rally and hear people tell you the things that weren't in the newspapers. Now the things that aren't in the newspapers are all over the internet, with a lot of garbage, of course, but if you've got your wits about you, you sort out the truth from the garbage, and you have an idea of what's going on. So it's, if we continue to have a free internet in this country, we can never have tyranny. So it's either, and you know, the internet is like the canary in the coal mine. If they take away freedom of the internet, then it's time to really worry that things are going to clamp down. As long as we have the ability to reach people through the internet, it's absolutely premature to be talking about fascism or anything like that, because we have in this country today assets for communications between people which didn't exist in the old days. And I profoundly believe that the way the world can be made a better world, and America can go back to being a better America, it will have to come from the people. We cannot sit back and wait for Congress to do it. We cannot sit back and wait for the government to come up with a more democratic version of itself. It will come from pressure from the people, and the internet will be the tool.
If I can quote your own words from your conclusion, you noted that tyrannical oppression from above, no matter how invincible it may outwardly appear, is vulnerable to organized, nonviolent resistance when it is grounded in a sufficiently broad social base.
And the challenge will be to mobilize in this country the kind of broad social base that was successful in ousting the Soviet army from Poland when the right-wing church and the left-wing intellectuals and labor leaders were able to get together and forget that they disagreed about homosexuality, forget that they disagreed about abortion, and remember that they agreed on the importance of establishing democracy. That's what we have to fight for in this country.